beginning on the first day of a quarter moon. Beeswax candles, began another sheet. Drain honey from the comb. Remove dead bees, so far as possible. Melt comb with a small amount of water in a large cauldron. Skim bees, wings, and other impurities from surface of water. Drain water. Replace. Stir frequently for half an hour, then allow to settle. Drain water. Keep for use in sweetening. Purify with water twice more. My hand was getting tired, and I hadn't even gotten to the making of candle moulds, the twisting of wicks, and the hanging of candles to dry. Jenny, I called, how long does it take to make candles, counting everything? She laid the small shirt she was stitching in her lap, considering. Half a day to gather the combs, two to drain the honey, one if it's hot, one day to purify the wax, unless there's a lot or it's very dirty, then two. Half a day to make the wicks, one or two to make the moulds, half a day to melt the wax, pour the moulds and hang them to dry, say a week altogether. The dim lamplight and the sputtering quill were too much to contend with after the day's labours. I sat down next to Jenny and admired the tiny garment she was embroidering with nearly invisible stitches. Her rounded stomach suddenly heaved as the inhabitant shifted position. I watched, fascinated. I had never been close to someone pregnant for a prolonged period and hadn't realised the amount of activity that went on inside. "Would you like to feel it?" Jenny offered, seeing me staring at her middle. "Well?" She took my hand and placed it firmly on her mound. "Right there. Just wait a moment. He'll kick again soon. They don't like you lying back like this, you know. It makes them restless and they start to squirm." Sure enough, a surprisingly vigorous push raised my hand by several inches. "Goodness, he's strong!" I exclaimed. "Aye." Jenny patted her stomach with a touch of pride. "He'll be bonny like his brother and his da." She smiled across at Ian, whose attention had momentarily wandered from the breeding records of horses to his wife and child-to-be. "Or even like his good-for-nothing red-headed uncle," she added, raising her voice slightly and nudging me. "Hey?" Jamie looked up, distracted from his accounts. "Were you speaking to me?" "I wonder if it was the red-headed or the good-for-nothing that caught his attention," Jenny said to me, sotto voce, with another nudge. To Jamie, she said sweetly, "Nothing at all, Mukri. We were just speculating on the possibility that the new one would have the misfortune to resemble its uncle." The uncle in question grinned and came across to sit on the hassock, Jenny amiably moving her feet, then replacing them in his lap. "Rub them for me, Jamie," she begged. "You're better at it than Ian." He obliged, and Jenny leaned back and closed her eyes in bliss. She dropped the tiny shirt on her central mound, which continued to heave as though in protest. Jamie stared entranced at the movements, just as I had.
"Isn't it uncomfortable?" he asked. "Having someone turn somersaults in your belly."
Jenny opened her eyes and grimaced as a long swell arced across her stomach. Sometimes I feel my liver's black and blue from being kicked, but mostly it's a good feeling instead. It's like..." She hesitated, then grinned at her brother. "It's hard to describe to a man, you not having the proper parts. I don't suppose I could tell you what carrying a child feels like, no more than you could tell me what it's like to be kicked in the bollocks."
"Oh, I could tell you that."
He promptly doubled up, clasping himself, and rolled his eyes back in his head with a hideous gurgling groan.
"Is that not right, Ian?" he asked, turning his head toward the stool where Ian sat laughing, wooden leg propped on the hearth.
His sister put a delicate foot on his chest and pushed him upright. "All right then, clown. In that case, I'm glad I haven't got any." Jamie straightened up and brushed the hair out of his eyes.
"No, really," he said, interested. "Is it just that the parts are different? Could you describe it to Claire?" After all, she's a woman, though she's not born a child yet.
Jenny eyed my midriff appraisingly, and I felt that small pang once more. Perhaps. She spoke slowly, thinking. You feel as though your skin is very thin all over. You feel everything that touches you, even the rubbing of your clothes, and not just on your belly, but over your legs and flanks and breasts.
Her hands went to them unconsciously, curving the lawn under the swelling rounds.
They feel heavy and full, and they're very sensitive, just at the tips.
The small blunt thumb slowly circled the breasts, and I saw the nipples rise against the cloth.
And of course you're big and you're clumsy.
Jenny smiled ruefully, rubbing the spot on her hip where she had banged against the table earlier.
You take up more room than you're used to. Here, though, her hands rose protectively to the top of her stomach. That's where you feel things most, of course.
She caressed the rounded bulge as though it were her child's skin she stroked, rather than her own. Ian's eyes following her hands as they moved from top to bottom of the curving hillock, over and over, smoothing the fabric again and again.
In the early days, it's a bit like belly gas, she said, laughing.
She poked a toe into her brother's midsection.
Just there, like little bubbles rippling through your belly. But then, later, you feel the child move, and it's like a fish on your line and then gone, like a quick tug. But so soon past, you're not sure you felt it.
As though in protest at this description, her unseen companion heaved to and fro, making her stomach bulge on one side, then the other.
I imagine you're sure by this time, Jamie remarked, following the movement with fascination.
Why?
She placed a hand on one bulge, as though to quiet it.
They sleep, you know, for hours at a time. Sometimes you fear they've died when there's no movement for a long time. Then you try to wake them.
Her hand pushed in sharply at the side and was rewarded immediately by a strong push in the opposite direction.
And you're happy when they kick again. But it's not just the babe itself. You feel swollen all over near the end. Not painful. Just so ripe you could burst.
It's as though you need to be touched very lightly all over. Jenny was no longer looking at me. Her eyes held her husband's, and I knew she was no longer aware of me or her brother. There was an air of intimacy between her and Ian, as though this were a story often told, but one of which they never tired. Her voice was lower now, and her hands rose again to her breasts, heavy and compelling under the light bodice.
And in the last month or so, the milk begins to come in. You feel yourself filling, just a wee bit at a time, a little each time the child moves. And then suddenly, everything comes up hard and round.
She cupped her stomach again.
There's no pain then, just a breathless feeling. And then your breasts tingle as though they'll explode if they're not suckled.
She closed her eyes and leaned back, stroking her massive belly over and over, with a rhythm like the invocation of a spell. It came to me, watching her, that if ever there were such a thing as a witch, then Janet Fraser was one. The smoky air was filled with the trance over the room. The feeling that lies at the root of lust, the terrible yearning need to join and create. I could have counted every hair on Jamie's body without looking at him, and knew each one stood erect. Jenny opened her eyes, dark in the shadows, and smiled at her husband, a slow, rich curve of infinite promise.
And late in bearing, when the child moves a lot, sometimes there's a feeling like when you've your man inside you, when he comes to you deep and pours himself into you.
Then when that throbbing starts deep inside you along with him, it's like that, but it's much bigger. It ripples all through the walls of your womb and fills all of you.
The child's quiet then, and it's though it's him you've taken inside you instead. Suddenly, she turned to me, and the spell was broken. That's what they want sometimes, you know, she said quietly, smiling into my eyes. They want to come back. Some time later, Jenny rose, floating toward the door with a glance back that pulled Ian after her like iron to true north. She paused near the door for him, looking back at her brother, who sat still by the fire hearth. You'll see to the fire, Jimmy. She stretched, arching her back, and the curve of her spine echoed the strangely sinuous curve of her belly. Ian's knuckles pressed hard along the length of her back and ground into the base of her spine, making her groan. And then they were gone. I stretched too, arms upward, feeling the pleasant pull of tired muscles. Jamie's hands ran down my sides and rested on the swell of my hips. I leaned back into him, drawing his hands forward, imagining them cupping the gentle curve of an unborn child. As I turned my head to kiss him, I noticed the small form curled in the corner of the settle. Look, they've forgotten small Jamie. The little boy customarily slept on a trundle in his parents' room. Tonight he had fallen asleep by the fire while we sat talking over the wine, but no one had remembered to carry him up to his bed. My own Jamie turned me to face him, smoothing my hair away from his nose.
Jenny never forgets anything, he said. I expect she and Ian do not care for company just now.
His hands went to the fastening at the back of my skirt.
He'll do where he is for the present.
But what if he wakes up?
The roving hands came up under the now loose edge of the bodice. Jamie cocked an eyebrow at the recumbent form of his small nephew.
Aye, well, he'll have to learn his job sometime, won't he? You don't want him to be as ignorant as his uncle was.
He tossed several cushions to the floor before the fire and lowered himself, carrying me with him. The firelight gleamed on the silvery scars on his back, as though he were, in fact, the Iron Man I had once accused him of being, the metal core showing through the rents in the fragile skin. I traced the lash marks one by one, and he shivered under my touch.
"Do you think Jenny's right?"
I asked later. "Do men really want to come back inside? Is that why you make love to us?" A breath of laughter stirred the hair by my ear.
"Well, it's no usually the first thing in my mind when I take you to bed, Sassenach. Far from it. But then..."
His hands cupped my breast softly, and his lips closed on one nipple.
"I'd no just say she was completely wrong, either.
Sometimes..."
"Aye. Sometimes it would be good to be inside again, safe and one. Knowing we cannot, I suppose, is what makes us want to beget. If we cannot go back ourselves, the best we can do is to give that precious gift to our sons, at least for a little while."
He shook himself suddenly, like a dog flinging water from its coat.
"Pay me no mind, Sassenach," he murmured. "I get very maudlin drinking elderberry wine."
Chapter 31. Quarter Day. There was a light knock on the door, and Jenny stepped in, carrying a folded blue garment over her arm and a hat in one hand. She looked her brother over critically, then nodded.
"Aye, the shirt's well enough, and I've let out your best coat for you. You've grown a bit through the shoulders since I saw you last."
She cocked her head to one side, considering.
"You've done a broad job of it today, up to the neck at least. Sit you down over there and I'll tend to your hair."
She pointed to the stool by the window.
"My hair? What's wrong with my hair?"
Jamie demanded, putting a hand up to check. Grown nearly to shoulder length, he had, as usual, laced it back with a leather thong to keep it out of his face. Wasting no time on chat, his sister pushed him down onto the stool, yanked the thong loose, and began to brush him vigorously with the tortoiseshell brushes. "What's wrong with your hair?" she asked rhetorically. "We'll know. There's cockle burrs in it, for one thing." She plucked a small brown object delicately from his head and dropped it on the dresser. "And bits of oak leaf. Where were you yesterday, rootling under the trees like a hog? And more tangles than a skein of washed yarn? Ouch! Be still, Roy." Frowning with concentration, she picked up a comb and teased out the tangles, leaving a smooth, shining mass of auburn, copper, cinnamon and gold, all gleaming together in the morning sun from the window. Jenny spread it in her hands, shaking her head over it. "I kinda think why the good Lord would waste hair like that on a man," she remarked, "like a red deer's pelt in places." "It is wonderful, isn't it?" I agreed. "Look, where the sun's bleached it on top, he's got those lovely blonde streaks." The object of our admiration glowered up at us. "If you both dinna stop it, I shall shave my head." He stretched out a threatening hand towards the dresser, where his razor rested. His sister, deft in spite of the enormous bulge of pregnancy, reached out and smacked his wrist with a hairbrush. He yelped, then yelped again as she yanked the hair back into a fistful. "Keep still," she ordered. She began to separate the hair into three thick strands. "I'll make you a proper cocker nonny," she declared with satisfaction. "I'll no have you going down to your tenants looking like a savage." Jamie muttered something rebellious under his breath, but subsided under his sister's ministrations. Dexterously tucking in stray bits here and there, she plaited the hair into a thick formal queue, tucking the ends under and binding them securely with thread. Then she reached into her pocket, pulled out a blue silk ribbon, and triumphantly tied it in a bow. "There," she said. "Bonny, no?" She turned to me for confirmation, and I had to admit it. The closely bound hair set off the shape of his head and the bold modelling of his face. Clean and orderly in snowy linen and grey breeches, he cut a wonderful figure. "Especially the ribbon," I said, suppressing an urge to laugh, "the same colour as his eyes." Jamie glared at his sister. "No," he said shortly, "no ribbons. This isna France, nor yet King George's court. I dinna care if it's the colour of the Virgin's cloak. No ribbons, Janet." "Oh, all right then, Fussport. There." She pulled the ribbon loose and stood back. "Aye, you'll do," she said with satisfaction. Then she turned her penetrating blue eyes on me. "Hmm," she said, tapping her foot thoughtfully. As I had arrived more or less in rags, it had been necessary to make me two new gowns as quickly as possible, one of homespun for daily use, and one of silk for occasions of state such as this. Better at stitching wounds than cloth, I had helped with the cutting and pinning, but been obliged to leave the design and sewing to Jenny and Mrs. Crook. They had done a beautiful job, and the primrose yellow silk fitted my torso like a glove, with deep folds rolling back over the shoulders and falling behind in panels that flowed into the luxuriant drape of the full skirt. Bowing reluctantly to my absolute refusal to wear corsets, they had instead ingeniously reinforced the upper bodice with whalebone stays ruthlessly stripped from an old corset. Jenny's eyes travelled slowly upward from my feet to my head, where they lingered. With a sigh, she reached for the hairbrush. "You too," she said. I sat, face burning, avoiding Jamie's eyes as she carefully removed small twigs and bits of oak leaf from my curls, depositing them on the dresser next to those sane from her brother's hair. Eventually my hair was combed out and pinned up, and she reached into her pocket and pulled out a small lace cap. "There," she said, pinning it firmly to the top of my pile of curls. "Catch and all. Very respectable you look, Claire." I assumed this was meant as a compliment, and murmured something in reply. "Have you any jewellery, though?" Jenny asked. I shook my head. "No, I'm afraid not. All I had were the pearls Jamie gave me for our wedding, and those..." Under the circumstances of our departure from Leoch, Pearls have been the last thing on my mind.
Oh, Jamie exclaimed, suddenly reminded. He dug in the sporran resting on the dresser and triumphantly pulled out the string of pearls.
Where on earth did you get those?
I asked in amazement. Murta brought them early this morning, he answered. He went back to Leoch during the trial and got everything he could carry, thinking that we'd need it if we got away. He looked for us on the road here, but of course we'd gone to the hill first.
Is he still here?
I asked.
Jamie stood behind me to fasten the necklace.
Oh, aye. He's downstairs eating everything in the kitchen and deviling Mrs. Crook.
Aside from his songs, I had heard the wiry little man say less than 36 words throughout the course of our acquaintanceship, and the thought of his devilling anyone was incongruous. He must feel remarkably at home at Lallybroch, I thought.
Who is Murta? I asked. I mean, is he a relation of yours?
Jamie and Jenny both looked surprised.
Why?
The latter replied. She turned to her brother.
He's what, Jamie? Father's second cousin's uncle?
Nephew, he corrected. You dinna remember. Old Leo had the two boys, and then...
I put my hands over my ears in a marked manner. This seemed to remind Jenny of something, for she clapped her hands together.
Earbobs, she exclaimed. I think I've some pearl ones that will just do with that necklace. I'll fetch them directly.
She vanished with her usual light speed.
Why does your sister call you Roy?
I asked curiously, watching as he tied his stock before the looking-glass. He wore the customary expression of a man doing battle with a mortal enemy, common to all men adjusting their neckwear, but he unclamped his lips to grin at me.
Och, that! It isn't the English name, Roy. It's a pet name in Gaelic. The colour of my hair.
The words Roy, R-U-A-D-H, means red.
He had to spell the word and say it over several times before I could catch any difference.
Sounds the same to me, Roy, I said, shaking my head.
Jamie picked up his sporran and began tucking in the loose bits of things that had come out when he pulled out the pearls. Finding a tangled length of fishing line, he upended the bag over the bed, dumping everything in a pile. He began to sort through it, painstakingly winding up the bits of line and string, finding loose fish hooks and firmly re-embedding them in the piece of cork where they normally rested. I moved over to the bed and inspected the array.
I've never seen so much rubbish in my life, I observed. You're a regular jackdaw, Jamie.
It is not rubbish, he said, stung. I've uses for all these things.
Well, the fish lines and the hooks, yes, and the string for snares. Even, stretching a point, the pistol wadding and the balls. You do carry a pistol now and again.
And the little snake Willie gave you, I understand that. But the stones, and a snail shell, and a piece of glass, and... I bent closer to peer at a dark furry mass of something.
What is it?
It isn't, is it?
Jamie, why on earth are you carrying a dried mole's foot in your sporran?
Against rheumatism, of course.
He snatched the object from under my nose and stuffed it back in the badger skin.
Oh, of course, I agreed, surveying him with interest.
His face was mildly flushed with embarrassment.
It must work. You don't creak anywhere.
I picked a small Bible out of the remaining rubble and thumbed through it while he stowed away the rest of his valuable equipment. Alexander William Roderick MacGregor. I read aloud the name on the flyleaf.
You said there was a debt owing him, Jamie. What did you mean by that?
Oh, that.
He sat down beside me on the bed, took the small book from me, and gently flipped the pages.
I told you this belonged to a prisoner who died at Fort William, no?
Yes.
I didn't know the lad myself. He died a month before I came there. But the doctor who gave it to me told me about him while he tended my back. I think he needed to tell someone about it, and he couldn't speak to anyone in the garrison.
He closed the book, holding it on his knee. and stared out the window at the gay October sunshine. Alex MacGregor, a lad of 18 or so, had been arrested for the common offence of cattle lifting. A fair, quiet lad, he had seemed likely to serve his sentence and be released without incident. A week before his release, though, he had been found hanging in the horse shed.
There was no doubt he'd done it himself, the doctor said.
Jamie caressed the leather cover of the small book, drawing one large thumb along the binding.
And he didn't exactly say what he thought himself. But he did say that Captain Randall had had a private conversation with the lad a week before.
I swallowed, suddenly cold despite the sunshine. And you think?
No.
His voice was soft and certain.
I dinna think. I know. And so did the doctor. And I imagine the sergeant major knew for certain, and that's why he died.
He spread his hands flat on his knees, looking down at the long joints of his fingers. Large, strong and capable, the hands of a farmer, the hands of a warrior. He picked up the small Bible and put it into the sporran.
I'll tell you this, Madonna. One day Jack Randall will die at my hands, and when he is dead, I shall send back that book to the mother of Alex MacGregor, with word that her son is avenged.
The air of tension was broken by the sudden reappearance of Jenny, now resplendent in blue silk and her own lace kerch, holding a large box of worn red Morocco leather. Jimmy, the Currans are come, and Willie Murray and the Jeffreys. You'd best go down and have a second breakfast with them. I've put out fresh bannocks and salt herring, and Mrs. Crook's doing fresh jam cakes.
Oh, aye. Claire, come down when you're ready.
Rising hastily, he paused long enough to gather me up for a brief but thorough kiss, and disappeared. His footsteps clattered down the first flight of stairs, slowing on the second to the more sedate pace suitable to a laird's entrance as he neared the ground floor. Jenny smiled after him, then turned her attention to me. Placing the box on the bed, she threw back the lid, revealing a jumbled array of jewels and baubles.
I was surprised to see it. It seemed unlike the neat, orderly Jenny Murray, whose iron hand kept the household running smoothly from dawn to dusk.
She stirred a finger through the bright clutter, then, as though picking up my thought, looked up and smiled at me. I keep thinking I must sort all these things one day, but when I was small, my mother would let me rummage in her box sometimes, and it was like finding magic treasure. I never knew what I'd pick up next. I suppose, I think if it were all orderly, the magic would go somehow. Daft, no?
No, I said, smiling back at her. No, it isn't.
We rummaged slowly through the box, holding the cherished bits and pieces of four generations of women. That was my grandmother Fraser's, Jenny said, holding up a silver brooch. It was the shape of a fretworked crescent moon, a small single diamond shining above the tip like a star. And this? She pulled out a slender gold band with a ruby surrounded by brilliants. That's my wedding ring. Ian spent half a year's salary on it, though I told him he was foolish to do it. The fond look on her face suggested that Ian had been anything but foolish. She polished the stone on the bosom of her dress and admired it once more before replacing it in the box. "I'll be happy once the baby's born," she said, patting her bulge with a grimace. "My fingers are so swollen in the mornings I can scarcely do up my laces, let alone wear my rings." I caught a strange non-metallic gleam in the depths of the box and pointed. "What's that?" "Oh, those," she said, dipping into the box again. "I've never worn them. They don't suit me. But you could wear them. You're tall and queenly, like my mother was. They were hers, you can." They were a pair of bracelets, each made from the curving, almost circular tusk of a wild boar, polished to a deep ivory glow, the ends capped with silver tappets, etched with flowered tracery. "Lord, they're gorgeous! I've never seen anything so..."
so wonderfully barbaric.
Jenny was amused.
Aye, that they are. Someone gave them to Mother as a wedding gift, but she never would say who.
My father used to tease her now and then about her admirer, but she wouldn't tell him either. Just smiled like a cat that's had cream to its supper.
Here, try them.
The ivory was cool and heavy on my arm. I couldn't resist stroking the deep yellow surface, grained with age.
Aye, they suit you, Jenny declared, and they go with that yellow gown as well. Here are the earbobs. Put these on, and we'll go down.
Murta was seated at the kitchen table, industriously eating ham off the end of his dirk. Passing behind him with a platter, Mrs. Crook dexterously bent and slid three fresh hot bannocks onto his plate, hardly breaking her stride. Jenny was bustling to and fro, preparing and overseeing. Pausing in her progress, she peered over Murta's shoulder at his rapidly emptying plate.
"Don't stint yourself, man," she remarked. "There's another hog in the pen, after all."
"Begrudge a kinsman a bite, do you?" he asked, not interrupting his chewing.
"Me?"
Jenny put both hands on her hips.
"Heavens, no. After all, you've only had the four helpings so far. Mrs. Crook,"
she turned to call to the departing housekeeper,
"when you've done with the bannocks, fix this starveling man a bowl of porridge to fill in the chinks with. We dinna want him fainting on the doorstep, you ken."
When Murta saw me standing in the doorway, he promptly choked on a bite of ham.
"Mm-hmm,"
he said, by way of greeting, after Jenny had pounded him helpfully on the back.
"Nice to see you too," I replied, sitting down opposite him.
"Thank you, by the way."
"Mm-hmm."
The question was muffled by half a bannock spread with honey.
"For fetching my things from the castle."
"Mm."
He dismissed any notion of thanks with a wave that ended in a reach for the butter dish.
"I brought your wee bits of plants and such as well,"
he said, with a jerk of the head at the window.
"Out in the yard, in my saddlebags."
"You've brought my medicine box. That's wonderful."
I was delighted. Some of the medicinal plants were rare, and had taken no little trouble to find and prepare properly.
"But how did you manage?" I asked.
Once I had recovered from the horror of the witchcraft trial, I often wondered how the occupants of the castle had taken my sudden arrest and escape.
"I hope you didn't have any difficulty."
"Oh, no."
He took another healthy bite, but waited until it had made its leisurely way down his throat before replying further.
"Mrs. Fitz had them put away, like, packed up in a box already. I went to her at the first chicken, for I wasn't sure what reception I'd get."
"Very sensible. I don't imagine Mrs. Fitz would scream at the sight of you," I agreed. The bannocks were steaming gently in the cool air and smelt heavenly. I reached for one, the heavy boar's tooth bracelets clinking together on my wrist. I saw Murta's eyes on them and adjusted them so he could see the engraved silver end pieces.
"Aren't they lovely?" I said. "Jenny said they were her mother's."
Murta's eyes dropped to the bowl of porridge that Mrs. Crook had thrust unceremoniously under his nose.
"They suit you," he mumbled.
Then, returning suddenly to the earlier subject, he said,
"No, she wouldn't summon help against me. I was well acquaint with Glenna Fitzgibbons some time ago."
"Oh, a long-lost love of yours, was she?" I teased,
enjoying the incongruous thought of him entwined in amorous embrace with the ample Mrs. Fitz. Murta glanced up coldly from his porridge.
"That she wasn't, and I'll thank you to keep a civil tongue when you speak of the lady. Her husband was my mother's brother, and she was sore grieved for you, I'll hear you to know."
I lowered my eyes, abashed, and reached for the honey to cover my embarrassment. The stone jar had been set in a pot of boiling water to liquefy the contents, and it was comfortingly warm to the touch. "I'm sorry," I said, drizzling the sweet golden fluid over the bannock, watching carefully so as not to spill it. "I wondered, you know, what she felt like when I...
They didn't realize at the first you were gone.
the little man said matter-of-factly, ignoring my apology.
When you didn't come in to dinner, they thought maybe you'd stayed late in the fields and gone up to your bed without eating. Your door was closed. And the next day, when there was all the outcry over the taking of Mistress Duncan, no one thought to look for you. There was no mention of you, only of her, when the news came. And in all the excitement, no one thought to look for you.
I nodded thoughtfully. No one would have missed me, save those seeking medical treatment. I had spent most of my time in Colum's library while Jamie was away. "What about Colum?" I asked. I was more than idly curious. Had he really planned it, as Geely thought? Murta shrugged. He scanned the table for further victuals, apparently spotted nothing to his liking, and leaned back, folding his hands comfortably over his lean midriff.
When he had the news from the village, he had the gates closed at once, and forbade anyone from the castle to go down, for fear of being caught up in the moil.
He leaned further back, eyeing me speculatively.
Mrs. Fitz thought to find you the second day. She said that she'd asked all the maids if they'd laid eyes on you. No one had, but one of the girls said she thought perhaps you'd gone to the village. Maybe you'd taken shelter in a house there.
One of the girls, I thought cynically. The one that knew bloody well where I was. He belched softly, not bothering to stifle the sound.
I heard Mrs. Fitz turn the castle upside down then and made Colum send down a man to the village once she was sure you weren't to be found. And when they learned what had happened...
A faint look of amusement lighted the dark face.
She didn't tell me everything, but I gathered she made himself's life more of a misery to him than it usually is, nagging at him to send down and free ye by force of arms, and not the least bit of use him arguing that it had all gone well beyond the point where he could do that, and now it was in the hands of the examiners and one thing and another. "It must have been something to see," he said reflectively. "Twa wills like that set one against the other."
And in the end, it seemed, neither had either triumphed nor given way. Ned Gowan, with his lawyer's gift for compromise, had found the way between them by offering to go himself to the trial, not as representative of the laird, but as an independent advocate.
"Did she think I might be a witch?" I asked curiously.
Murta snorted briefly.
"I've yet to see the old woman believes in witches. Nor the young one, neither. It's men think there must be ill wishes and magic in women, when it's only the natural way of the creatures."
"I begin to see why you've never married," I said.
"Do you, then?"
He pushed back his chair abruptly and rose, pulling the plaid forward over his shoulders.
"I'll be off. Gie my respects to the laird," he said to Jenny,
who reappeared from the front hall where she had been greeting tenants.
"He'll be busy, I've nae doot."
Jenny handed him a large cloth sack, tied in a knot at the mouth, and plainly holding enough provisions for a week.
"A wee bite for the journey home," she said, dimpling at him. "Might last ye at least out of sight of the house."
He tucked the knot of the sack snugly into his belt, and nodded briefly, turning toward the door.
"Aye," he said. "And if not, you'll see the Corbies gathering just beyond the rise. Come to pick my bones."
"A lot of good they'll get from it,"
she answered cynically, eyeing his scrawny frame. "I've seen more sound flesh on a broomstick." Murta's dour face remained unchanged, but a faint gleam showed in his eyes nonetheless.
"Oh, aye," he said. "Well, I'll tell you, lass."
The voices passed down the hall, mingling in amiable insult and argument, vanishing at last in the echoes of the front hall. I sat at the table for a moment longer, idly caressing the warm ivory of Ellen Mackenzie's bracelets. At the far-off slam of the door, I shook myself and stood up to take my place as the Lady of Lallybroch. Usually a busy place, on quarter day the manor house simply bristled with activity. Tenants came and went all day. Many came only long enough to pay their rents. Some stayed all day, wandering about the estate, visiting with friends, taking refreshment in the parlour.
Jenny, blooming in blue silk, and Mrs. Crook, starched in white linen, flitted back and forth between kitchen and parlour, overseeing the two maidservants, who staggered to and fro under enormous platters of oatcake, fruitcake, crumbly, and other sweets. Jamie, having introduced me with ceremony to the tenants present in dining room and parlour, then retired into his study with Ian, to receive the tenants singly, to confer with them over the needs of the spring planting, to consult over the sale of wool and grain, to note the activities of the estate, and to set things in order for the next quarter of the year. I puttered cheerfully about the place, visiting with tenants, lending a hand with the refreshments when needed, sometimes just drifting into the background to watch the comings and goings. Recalling Jamie's promise to the old woman by the mill pond, I waited with some curiosity for the arrival of Ronald McNab. He came shortly past noon, riding a tall, slip-jointed mule with a small boy clinging to his belt behind. I viewed them covertly from the parlour door, wondering just how accurate his mother's assessment had been. I decided that while drunken sot might be overstating things slightly, Granny McNab's general perceptions were acute. Ronald McNab's hair was long and greasy, carelessly tied back with twine, and his collar and cuffs were grey with dirt. While surely a year or two younger than Jamie, he looked at least 15 years older, the bones of his face submerged in bloat, small grey eyes dulled and bloodshot. As for the child, he also was scruffy and dirty. Worse, so far as I was concerned, he slunk along behind his father, keeping his eyes on the floor, cringing when Ronald turned and spoke sharply to him. Jamie, who had come to the door of his study, saw it too, and I saw him exchange a sharp look with Jenny, bringing a fresh decanter in answer to his call. She nodded imperceptibly and handed over the decanter. Then, taking the child firmly by the hand, she towed him toward the kitchen, saying, "Come along with me now, laddie. I believe we've a crumbly or two going wanting. Or what about a slice of fruitcake?" Jamie nodded formally to Ronald McNab, standing aside as the man went into the study. Reaching out to shut the door, Jamie caught my eye and nodded toward the kitchen. I nodded back and turned to follow Jenny and young Rabbi. I found them engaged in pleasant converse with Mrs. Crook, who was ladling punch from the big cauldron into a crystal bowl. She tipped a bit into a wooden cup and offered it to the lad, who hung back, eyeing her suspiciously before finally accepting it. Jenny went on chatting casually to the lad as she loaded platters, receiving little more than grunts in return. Still, the half-wild little creature seemed to be relaxing a bit. "Your sock's a bit grubby, lad," she observed, leaning forward to turn back the collar. "Take it off, and I'll give it a bit of a wash before you go." Grubby was a gross understatement, but the boy pulled back defensively. I was behind him, though, and at a gesture from Jenny, grabbed him by the arms before he could dart away. He kicked and yowled, but Jenny and Mrs. Crook closed in on him as well, and between the three of us, we peeled the filthy shirt off his back. "Ah!" Jenny drew in her breath sharply. She was holding the boy's head firmly under one arm, and the scrawny back was fully exposed. Welts and scabs scored the flesh on either side of the knobby backbone, some freshly healed, some so old as to be only faded shadows lapping the prominent ribs. Jenny took a good grip on the back of the boy's neck, speaking soothingly to him as she released his head. She jerked her head in the direction of the hall, looking at me. "You'd better tell him." I knocked tentatively at the study door, holding a plate of honeyed oatcakes as excuse. At Jamie's muffled bidding, I opened the door and went in. My face, as I served McNab, must have been sufficient, for I didn't have to ask to speak privately with Jamie. He stared meditatively at me for a moment, then turned back to his tenant.
"Well then, Ronnie, that will do for the green allotment. There's the one other thing I meant to speak with you about, though. You've a likely lad named Rabbi, I understand, and I'm needing a boy of that size to help in the stables. Would you be willing for him to come?
Jamie's long fingers played with a goose quill on the desk. Ian, seated at a smaller table to one side, propped his chin on his fists, staring at MacNab with frank interest. MacNab glowered belligerently. I thought he had the irritable resentment of a man who isn't drunk, but wishes he were.
No, I've need of the lad, he said curtly.
Jamie lounged back in his chair, hands folded across his middle.
I'd pay you for his services, of course.
The man grunted and shifted in his chair.
My mother's been at you, eh? I said no, and I meant no.
The lad's my son, and I'll deal with him as I see fit.
And I see fit to keep him to him.
Jamie eyed MacNab thoughtfully, but turned his attention back to the ledgers without further argument. Late in the afternoon, as the tenants repaired to the warmer reaches of pantry and parlour for refreshment before departing, I spotted Jamie from the window, strolling in a leisurely fashion toward the pig shed, arm slung about the scruffy MacNab in comradely style. The pair disappeared behind the shed, presumably to inspect something of agricultural interest, and reappeared within a minute or two, coming toward the house. Jamie's arm was still about the shorter man's shoulders, but seemed now to be supporting him. MacNab's face was an unhealthy grey slicked with sweat, and he walked very slowly, seeming unable to straighten up all the way.
"Well, that's good, then,"
Jamie remarked cheerfully as they came within earshot.
"Reckon your missus will be glad of the extra money, eh, Ronald? Ah, here's your animal for you. Fine-looking beast, is he, no?"
A moth-eaten mule that had brought the MacNabs to the farm shambled out of the yard, where it had been enjoying the hospitality of the estate. A wisp of hay still protruded from the corners of its mouth, jerking irregularly as the beast chewed. Jamie gave MacNab a hand under the foot to assist him to his seat, much-needed help by the look of it. MacNab didn't speak or wave in response to Jamie's voluble "Godspeeds" and "safe journeys," but only nodded in a dazed way as he left the yard at a walk, seeming intent on some secret trouble that absorbed his attention. Jamie stood leaning on the fence, exchanging pleasantries as other tenants wended their ways homeward, until the untidy figure of MacNab was out of sight over the crest of the hill. He straightened, gazing down the road, then turned and gave a whistle. A small figure in a torn but clean smock and stained kilt crept out from under the hay wagon.
"Well then, young Rabbi," said Jamie genially, "looks as though your father's given his permission for you to be a stable lad after all. I'm sure as you'll be a hard worker and a credit to him, eh?"
Round, bloodshot eyes stared up dumbly out of the dirty face, and the boy made no response at all, until Jamie reached out and, grasping him gently by the shoulder, turned him toward the horse trough.
"There'll be some supper waiting ye in the kitchen, laddie. Go and wash a bit first, though. Mrs. Crook's a picky woman. Oh, and Rabbi."
He leaned down to whisper to the lad,
"Mind your ears, or she'll do them for you. She scrubbed mine for me this morning."
He put his hands behind his ears and flapped them solemnly at the boy, who broke into a shy smile and fled toward the trough. "I'm glad you managed it," I said, taking Jamie's arm to go into supper. "With little Rabbi MacNab, I mean. How did you do it, though?" He shrugged.
"Took Ronald back of the brewhouse and fisted him once or twice in the soft parts. Asked him did he want to part with his son or his liver."
He glanced down at me, frowning.
"It wasn't right, but I couldn't think what else to do. And I didn't want the lad to go back with him. It wasn't only I'd promised his granny either. Jenny told me about the lad's back."
He hesitated.
"I'll tell you, Sassenach. My father whipped me as often as he thought I needed it, and a lot oftener than I thought I did. But I didn't a cower when he spoke to me. And I dinna think young Rabbi will lie in bed wi' his wife one day and laugh about it."
He hunched his shoulders with that odd half-shrug, something I hadn't seen him do in months.
He's right. The lad's his own son. He can do as he likes. And I'm not God, only the laird, and that's a good bit lower down. Still.
He looked down at me with a crooked half-smile.
It's a damn thin line between justice and brutality, Sassnach. I only hope I've come down on the right side of it.
I put an arm around his waist and hugged him. You did right, Jamie.
You think so?
Yes. We strolled back toward the house, arms about each other. The whitewashed farm buildings glowed amber in the setting sun. Instead of going into the house, though, Jamie steered me up the slight rise behind the manor. Here, sitting on the top rail of a fenced field, we could see the whole of the home farm laid out before us. I laid my head on Jamie's shoulder and sighed. He squeezed me gently in response.
This is what you were born to do, isn't it, Jamie?
Perhaps, Sassnach.
He looked out over the fields and buildings, the crofts and the roads, then looked down, a smile suddenly curving the wide mouth.
And you, Miss Sassnach, what were you born for? To be the lady of a manor, or to sleep in the fields like a gypsy? To be a healer, or a Don's wife, or an outlaw's lady?
I was born for you, I said simply, and held out my arms to him.
You know, he observed, letting go at last. You've never said it.
Neither have you.
I have, the day after we came. I said I wanted you more than anything.
And I said that loving and wanting weren't necessarily the same thing, I countered. He laughed.
Perhaps you're right, Sassnach.
He smoothed the hair from my face and kissed my brow.
I wanted you from the first I saw you, but I loved you when you wept in my arms and let me comfort you that first time at Leoch.
The sun sank below the line of black pines, and the first stars of the evening came out. It was mid-November, and the evening air was cold, though the days still kept fine. Standing on the opposite side of the fence, Jamie bent his head, putting his forehead against mine.
You first.
No, you.
Why?
I'm afraid.
Of what, Miss Sassnach?
The darkness was rolling in over the fields, filling the land and rising up to meet the night. The light of the new crescent moon marked the ridges of brow and nose, crossing his face with light.
I'm afraid if I start, I shall never stop.
He cast a glance at the horizon where the sickle moon hung low and rising.
It's nearly winter, and the nights are long, Modunya.
He leaned across the fence, reaching, and I stepped into his arms, feeling the heat of his body and the beat of his heart.
I love you.
Chapter 32. Hard Labour. A few days later, near sunset, I was on the hill behind the house, digging up the tubers of a small patch of corydalis I had found. Hearing the rustle of footsteps approaching through the grass, I turned, expecting to see Jenny or Mrs. Crook come to call me to supper. Instead, it was Jamie, hair spiked with dampness from his pre-dinner ablutions, still in his shirt, knotted together between his legs for working in the fields. He came up behind me and put his arms around me, resting his chin on my shoulder. Together we watched the sun sink behind the pines, robed in gold and purple glory. The landscape faded quietly around us, but we stayed where we were, wrapped in contentment. Finally, as it began to grow dark, I could hear Jenny calling from the house below.
"We better go in," I said, reluctantly stirring.
Jamie didn't move, but merely tightened his hold, still gazing into the deepening shadows, as though trying to fix each stone and blade of grass in memory. I turned to him and slipped my arms around his neck.
"What is it?" I asked quietly.
"Must we leave soon?" My heart sank at the prospect of leaving Lallybroch.
but I knew that it was dangerous for us to stay too much longer. Another visit from the Redcoats could happen at any time, with much more sinister results.
Aye, tomorrow, or the day after at latest. There are English at Nochoilum. There's 20 miles from here, but that's only 2 days' ride in fine weather.
I started to slither off the fence, but Jamie slid an arm under my knees and lifted me, holding me against his chest. I could feel the heat of the sun still in his skin and smell the warm, dusty scent of sweat and oat grass. He'd been helping with the last of the harvesting, and the smell reminded me of a supper the week before, when I knew that Jenny, always friendly and polite, had finally accepted me fully as a member of the family. Harvesting was grueling work, and Ian and Jamie were often nodding by the end of supper. On one occasion, I had left the table to fetch a brose pudding for dessert, and returned to find both of them sound asleep, and Jenny laughing quietly to herself amid the remains of supper. Ian lay slumped in his chair, chin resting on his chest, breathing heavily. Jamie had laid his cheek on his folded arms and sprawled forward across the table, snoring peacefully between the platter and the pepper mill. Jenny took the pudding from me and served us both, shaking her head at the slumbering men.
"They were yawning so much. I wondered, you know," she said, "what would happen if I stopped talking. So I kept quiet. And sure enough, 2 minutes later they were out, the both of them."
She smoothed Ian's hair tenderly off his forehead.
"That's why there are so few babies born in July here," she said, with a wicked cock of the eyebrow at me. "The men can't keep awake long enough in November to start one."
It was true enough, and I laughed. Jamie stirred and snorted next to me, and I laid a hand on the back of his neck to soothe him. His lips curved at once in a soft, reflexive smile, then relaxed into sleep once more. Jenny, watching him, said, "That's funny, that is. I've not seen him do that since he was quite small."
"Do what?"
She nodded.
"Smile in his sleep.
He always used to do it if he came by and petted him in his cradle, or even later in his trundle. Sometimes Mother and I would take it in turns to stroke his head and see could we make him smile. He always would."
"That's odd, isn't it?"
I experimented, running a hand gently down the back of his head and neck. Sure enough, I was rewarded at once by a singularly sweet smile that lingered for a moment before the lines of his face relaxed once more into the rather stern expression he presented when asleep.
"I wonder why he does that," I said, watching him in fascination.
Jenny shrugged and grinned at me.
"I imagine it means he's happy."
In the event, we didn't leave next day. In the middle of the night, I was wakened by low conversation in the room. Rolling over, I saw Ian bending over the bed, holding a candle.
"The babe's on its way," said Jamie, seeing me awake.
He sat up, yawning.
"A bit early, Ian."
"You never know. Small Jimmy was late. Better early than late, I reckon."
Ian smiles, quick and nervous.
"Sassenach, can you deliver a child? Or had I best go for the midwife?"
Jamie turned to me, questioning. I didn't hesitate in my answer. I shook my head. "Get the midwife." I had seen only 3 births during my training, all conducted in a sterile operating room, the patient draped and anaesthetized, nothing visible save the grotesquely swelling perineum and the suddenly emergent head. Having seen Jamie on his way to fetch the midwife, Mrs. Martins, I followed Ian up the stairs. Jenny was sitting in a chair near the window, leaning comfortably back. She had put on an old nightgown, stripped the bed, and spread an aged quilt over the feather mattress, and was now just sitting, waiting. Ian hovered nervously over her. Jenny smiled too, but with a distracted inward look, as though listening to something far off which only she could hear. Ian, fully dressed, fidgeted about the room, picking things up and putting them down, until Jenny at last ordered him to leave.
"Go downstairs and rouse Mrs. Crook, Ian," she said, smiling to ease the dismissal. "Tell her to get things ready for Mrs. Martin's. She'll ken what to do." She drew in her